she sits by the riverside, watching the waters glide by with a sigh.
Well, hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for fans and collectors of vinyl records. And this week we are talking about the legendary prog rock band Gentle Giant, with band founder, musician-turned-record executive, Derek Shulman. Now today we're going to talk about the history of Gentle Giant, the Rare Records, the early days of Simon Dupree and the Big Sound, their run-ins with the Beatles, the lost master tapes, and heaps more, including a discussion on the newly remastered Gentle Giant vinyl release, Three-Piece Suite, a collection of songs from the first three Gentle Giant albums, remastered by Steven Wilson, and available on vinyl, or of course you can get the 5-to-1 mix on Blu-ray, anywhere fine music is purchased. Oh, you are going to enjoy this show, and it's brought to you in part this week by the best manual record cleaner in the universe. Yes, I'm talking about the Groove Washer. Recently, I bought a box of old dirty 45 singles from a charity shop. They were dirty, they were covered in grime. In fact, they were about to throw them into the garbage. I sat down a few weeks ago with a Groove Washer and their awesome G2 fluid, and I cleaned them all. Even some of the records were collectible. I found some first issue Beatles singles, some Who singles. I even found some 80s records, which now look and sound brilliant thanks to the Groove Washer. I posted a bunch of pictures on our Facebook and Instagram pages of what those records look like now, and it's exactly why I love Groove Washer. Get your own kit today, starting at $30 at groovewasher.com. And with that, let's talk to Derek Shulman about the history and the records of Gentle Giant.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
All right, I heard my name. I guess it's time to get started. Hi, everyone. It's Nate, host of The Vinyl Guide podcast. Every Monday, we release an episode and we talk about vinyl records. If you like listening to your music on vinyl records, you have yourself a little record collection started, or a big record collection, well, look no further. This is your community. Have yourself a seat. Put your bag down over there. Grab yourself a nice cold beer out of the fridge. And grab me one, too, while you're up. That'd be great. Anyway, hope you're doing well. Hope you had a good week. I've been up to quite a bit of cool stuff. I can't tell you right now, but we've been doing some great interviews, lining up some great guests for the coming months. Man, oh man, are you guys in for a real treat. You know, I do need a favor from you guys, though, especially you loyal listeners out there. Need you to share this podcast. We're trying to grow our Vinyl Guide community. Make sure to get your friends to subscribe to the Vinyl Guide. I know there's a lot of folks out there that are record collectors that aren't quite familiar with how exactly to listen to a podcast, so do me a favor. And your friends a favor at the same time, grab that smartphone of theirs and show them how to get to the Vinyl Guide podcast, either their native podcast app, or you could download the Vinyl Guide podcast app from Google or Apple Store. Get them involved and get them to where they can listen to the Vinyl Guide each week. Help out your homies, spend a few minutes with them on their smartphone, and show them how to get the Vinyl Guide podcast. Much appreciated. Now, last week on the show, we had Jake Burns of the legendary punk band Stiff Little Fingers, a band that was formed in Belfast during the Northern Ireland conflict at a time when there was literally war in the streets. He talked about what it was like forming a punk band at that time, how they were inspired by bands of the day, how a Clash concert gone wrong made them think different. And he talked about the early Stiff Little Fingers records, getting played on the John Peel show, and now some 40-odd years later, how they are still inspiring bands. If you haven't heard it yet, you got to hear the story. It's episode 107 at thevinylguide.com. Now, this week, we shift from punk rock to prog rock. We have on the show Derek Shulman, who is a founding member of the band Gentle Giant. However, he's been in the music industry for many years, originally fronting Simon Dupree and the Big Sound, and eventually becoming a record executive, signing some of the more innovative bands of the last 20, 30 years. Now, today, Derek's going to share about his journey. We have quite a chat about Gentle Giant, the formation, the history, the record catalog, the missing Gentle Giant tapes, and also the new compilation LP, three-piece suite, a remastering of several Gentle Giant tracks from Steven Wilson. I have it. It sounds really nice. And in fact, I'm going to play a track right after the interview so you can hear the gorgeous mixes that are available as part of this compilation. Now, if you know Gentle Giant, you'll love this episode and, of course, the song. If you're new to Gentle Giant, well, you are really in for a treat. They rose up the same time, the same environment of Yes and Genesis and King Crimson. So Gentle Giant is part of that group. So if you haven't heard them yet, today's going to be a real treat because you're going to hear a band that maybe you're going to be inspired to go find some of their other works. I would, however, recommend you start with Three Piece Suite because it is a modern remastering with current mixing techniques, of course, and it is available on vinyl wherever you buy your records. All right, what a history this band has had. Without further ado, let's get on to the Vinyl Guide interview with Derek Shulman of Gentle Giant. This week on The Vinyl Guide, we're pleased to have Gentle Giant founder and music industry veteran and provocateur, Derek Shulman, on the show. Derek, how are you today?
I'm doing very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing good. It's a beautiful day here in Sydney and getting ready to have a great conversation about records and music and all that stuff. It doesn't get any better. So Gentle Giant has recently released Three Piece Suite, a collection of tracks from the first three Gentle Giant LPs, the self-titled Acquiring the Taste, Three Friends, remastered by Steven Wilson, and it sounds absolutely gorgeous. Why the compilation rather than remastering the first three albums in their entirety?
Well, the bottom line is that we were looking for the tapes of the three albums in the vaults of what was the old Phonogram, if you like. And to tell you the truth, we couldn't find them. We found one reel of tapes that had the songs that you hear on Three Piece Suite, and they were sort of pieced together. And so the bottom line was, I think they either were cut out or trashed or burnt by whoever was filing those first three albums. And so when Steven, what we told him, unfortunately, we couldn't find the first three albums. He said, well, you know what, why don't we just do a compilation? So really, it was his idea rather than us saying, why don't we do a compilation? Since then, however, we have discovered that someone who was a big collector had found the first album. But nevertheless, at the time when Steven said, let's try and get back to the first, when you first started, those are the only tracks we could find in the vault. So that's unfortunately the reason why it is, or fortunately or unfortunately, whatever you say.
I'm fascinated by what artists are able to keep over time or find over time, what they did. And we had the Queen archivist on, and apparently Brian May kept everything. I mean, every scrap of recording, every t-shirt design they sold. Then we had Ian Gillan on the show, and he destroys everything, outtakes and everything that he doesn't use. So totally unromantic about it. Let's talk about the tapes. Sadly, many do not survive. Mm-hmm. How do band tapes go missing?
Well, the band tapes go missing because generally the band is signed to a record label, and the record label, once the band is has either gone elsewhere or has been dropped or is no longer in existence, they are stuffed in a vault. And when the vaults are full, if they're not as important as a catalog item, they'll just either say, what do we do with them? Do we tape over them or do we just trash them? And for the most part, the older, you know, the 60s, 70s bands are basically trashed. Some studios have kept archives, but you know, remember, there were 4, 8, and 16 track tapes back then, and there were hundreds and hundreds, or should I say thousands and thousands of bands who had albums and singles back in the day. So basically, the the tapes, the multi-track tapes are generally owned by the labels, and the labels, once the band is not important or signed to them, don't really care. So that's the reason why a lot of bands don't have those have the ability to find the multis.
Now I realize that happened for cinema in the early part of the century. A lot of the films from the first half of the 20th century were destroyed because they were actually flammable, made out of silver nitrate or something like that. So they were actually dangerous and expensive to keep. But audio tapes, that's incredible that someone would throw away something, especially in the last 40, 50 years after they started realizing there could be future value in them beyond just the cost of the tape.
Well, the bottom line is, if the band is not, or the artist is not a gigantic artist, record labels were just looking for current bands that were selling, and catalog back in the day didn't really mean much. It does now, of course. So in that respect, we were lucky that we did find what we have found. But for the most part, there's a lot of bands who have not been able to find their multi-tracks, or the multi-tracks have actually been recorded over by other bands. So that happens, and unfortunately, it's true. The story is in fact that Stephen, who's a good friend of ours, Stephen Wilson, what he wanted to remix more than any of our records was In a Glass House, and the band and everyone we know in the business cannot find those multi-tracks anywhere. They've disappeared into thin air.
So In a Glass House is missing, Acquiring the Taste and Three Friends, or many of those tracks are missing. What else is missing?
I think that's it. I think we've got the multis for everything else, believe it or not. And in fact, we put Octopus out, as you probably know, with Stephen remixing that and The Power and the Glory. And after that, we've been able to save and have an archive the multis since then. But unfortunately, Acquiring the Taste and Three Friends were only partially saved, and we cannot find In a Glass House anywhere. So if anyone is listening and they know where they are, please give a ring or bell or whatever, because that one in particular is something we'd all love to get our hands on.
How do the multi-tracks for the first Gentle Giant LP come into the hands of a collector?
Well, the multi-tracks don't usually come into the hands of a collector. They usually are archived into the warehouse of the label and the company that have signed the band. The strange thing about the first album was that a collector was able to get hold of these multis, and whoever was looking after the first album, Gentle Giant. And this is we're talking about 25, 30 years ago. He went to London. It's a friend of ours in Sweden, and went to London and asked someone who was in charge of the warehouse, "Do you have Gentle Giant?" And they said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, could I borrow the tapes and put them on ADAT on the digital, and the digital, format?" And they said, "Sure." Without any kind of signing off or whatever. I mean, and so therefore, that's how we found, because he was a friend of the band's, when we were looking for the tapes, all we had was those tracks that we had. And after we had mixed the album the compilation, he said, "Oh, by the way, I have the ADAT of Gentle Giant." So back in the day, it was really not something that the people at those warehouses really cared about. So that's the bottom line here. They do now, of course.
He just walked in and asked for it. I mean, anyone could have done that.
Literally. Absolutely correct. Yeah.
And with the remixes by Stephen Wilson, again, they sound brilliant. And the relationship that Gentle Giant has had with Stephen Wilson has been very, very fruitful for the music lovers out there. Did he add or change anything to the songs along the way?
No, what Stephen does is he's very respectful about what was and what the band had done. What he does is, in fact, embellish some of the things we probably would have done back in the day had we had either time, energy, money, and or the technology. But as far as changing things to make it sound like a Stephen Wilson record. Absolutely not. He's very respectful and true to what the band wanted to put out there. He'll edge up certain levels of vocals. He'll tweak some kick drum a little harder at certain EQs. But for the most part, I mean, he'll make the sound of the music a little more separate than we probably would have had it. But had we had the time again and the energy and the money and time, etc., we may have done that. But at that, but he has the ability and you know the technology to do that now. So he really doesn't change that much. But what he does do is make it sound better, as you said, and I think so too.
So let's go back a little bit before Gentle Giant. You started off in the band Simon Dupree and the Big Sound, and that was with your other two brothers. You took on the name of Simon Dupree. What was the logic in having a pseudonym at that time?
The logic was that I was a singer, so you know there had to be a focus of some kind back in the mid to late 60s. And my brother-in-law, who was the manager at that time, believed and in fact in certain respects was correct in saying, okay, if you have a focus in the band that is a pop rock star in quotes, then it would be better than just having the somethings. So I took the mantle on as the singer, as Simon Dupree, and in fact, people used to say, you know, how are you doing, Simon? And I looked around and see who they were talking to. But of course, you know, and of course, you know, there's little stories like my brothers would be asked, what's it like to have a star as your brother? You know, so sibling rivalry at that point was a little heavy duty, as it were.
But there wasn't a Simon Dupree. I mean, why was it not Derek Shulman and the Big Sound?
Well, it's not exactly a star's name, is it? I mean, Derek Shulman, come on, it's a little hardcore, you know, sort of out, a little out there. It's not really a cute name. Simon Dupree is a cuter name.
Okay, all right. Well,
I think
I'll give you that.
Well, okay, you don't have to. That's okay.
You guys were assigned to Parlophone at the same time as the Beatles, and of course in the same city and country and the same environment and industry. You must have some sort of interesting stories about that intersection between you and the different musicians of the day.
Oh, if you're talking about the Beatles, which I assume you're talking about, we wanted to be on Parlophone to tell you that we were signed to EMI, and EMI had two or three labels. One was Columbia, one was Parlophone, etc. And we wanted to be on the same label as the Beatles, because you know they changed the world, they changed music, we recorded Abbey Road. Every record and every song we had was at Abbey Road, and we interacted with all of the bands of those days: Pink Floyd, the Beatles, all of them, because we had 3-hour sessions for the most part. All of the bands which were signed back in the day had 3-hour sessions with their respective producers. So yes, we had interactions with all of the sort of bands in the mid to late 60s who ultimately became the classic rock and prog and everything else bands in the 70s and 80s. So it was a fascinating time to be in the business, as it were. And kids who were naive and wanted to be rock stars, having no idea that how many years later, we would be there, if you like.
When you think about that time, what's your favorite Beatles story?
If a Beatles story, there was a story, and you may or may not know it, that when John and Yoko had their bed in, which was famous, I assume everyone knows about it. We were a kind of cynical bunch, if you like, and we still are, even after many, many decades. We saw the Beatles had been recording prior to our recording, because I said everyone recorded in a 3-hour session. So they were trooping out into the cafeteria, and we trooped in, and Phil, my elder brother Phil, and myself saw the bed there, and we just looked at each other and, you know, kind of raised our eyes saying, oh shit, so, you know, what the hell is that about? and my brother Phil started trampolining on the bed. And, you know, which we thought was a lot of fun. And then walks John and Yoko because they forgot their hat or something. And they were a little upset, to say the least. And I won't repeat what they said, but Phil got off the bed and skulked to the control room very, very quietly.
So lesson learned. That,
talk
a little bit about the moles. Tell us the story of how the moles came to be.
Okay, the story about the moles is and was that after Simon Dupree had a very, very big hit with a song called Kites, which is still, believe it or not, a kind of a classic hit of the mid to late 60s. It was a kind of a psychedelic thing. We were, it was a kind of an anathema to the band. We were really more of a R&B soul, really hardwired, like a Spencer Davis group, like an Episode Six, like all those bands of those days. And it was a kind of a, not really what the band was about. But unfortunately, or fortunately in a lot of ways, it became the hit, if you like, the biggest hit we had. And we had to follow it up with some other pop hits. We had a couple of other decent follow-ups, but the music was changing, and we were at that time wanting to expand our universe, if you like. So we decided to go to the studio in a 3-hour block and make, just me, Ray, and Phil, my brothers, just the three Shulman brothers, go in and put something down which sounded stupid and crazy. So we made this song up literally in the studio, and we decided to call it The Moles. And on the B-side, we literally made up a song there at the spot and in a three-hour session, and we mixed it with Jeff Emmerich as usual, and et cetera, et cetera. And EMI put it out, and it started gaining a huge buzz. It started becoming a hit. Someone who was in the studio waiting to come in had seen Simon Dupree and the Big Sound come out, and I'll say the name, Sid Barrett. Sid Barrett, from what I hear and what I heard about and I remembered, had seen us record, and basically when he was being interviewed in, either by Melody Maker or the Sounds or whatever, basically blew the whistle on us and saying, the Moles are not the Beatles or some new psychedelic great band. It's Simon Dupree. You don't want to listen to this. So our game was cut short, and we were screwed.
Okay, so you'd hoped it would stay anonymous. Was that the intent from the very beginning, or was it?
Anonymous until it became a big hit, and then we said, "Guess what? It's us." You know, and we've changed our sound, but we weren't able to do that.
Okay, because apparently there was a rumor that it was actually the Beatles performing as a different.
That's right. People thought it was either the Beatles or Pink Floyd or one of those big gigantic bands being anonymous, so that's why it got that kind of buzz. But again, Sid Barrett blew the whistle, so you know, good old Sid, you know, unfortunately he's not around anymore, but you know, if he was, I'd spank him.
So in dealing with moving away from Simon Dupree and the Big Sound, and then of course the venture with the Moles, the band then completely disbanded and Gentle Giant started to form. There was a major change in the sound. Was that a bit of rebellion over the Simon Dupree affair?
Yes, it was a rebellion because we were, as I said, we were a very high energy R&B soul, and a soul band who played live and did very, very well in all over Europe, actually. But we had a couple of big hits, especially the one gigantic hit called Kites. And we were starting to be booked in these pop venues where people would go to see the pop bands and hear the pop hits. And we wanted to expand our universe, expand our musicality. And for the most part, we were not able to because we were sort of bagged into this, these shows where Dave D, Dozy, Beacon, McIntitch, or Status Quo, et cetera, and Simon Dupree would have three or four songs, and you'd have to play those hits. Or clubs where they were eating scampi and chips, and you'd have to play the hits. And it became very depressing, to be honest with you, especially to me. I was really getting to a point where I said, I can't do this anymore. And so the bottom line was, we wanted to expand ourselves musically, but we weren't able to because we were kind of bagged with this one side, kind of like a millstone around our necks with a big hit. So we said, let's not do this anymore. Let's break up and do something else. Fortunately, we are very lucky in having a manager who believed in us, the Shulman Brothers, as a band, as the musicians, and as a band, and basically funded the formation of what became Gentle Giant. So we were lucky in that respect.
And how long was it between that time when the band was forming and the deal with Vertigo Records?
About a year. I mean, we basically broke up, signed with Decree and the Big Sound at the beginning of 1970, and really rehearsed. And at the same time, we interviewed, people that would be part of the band. Just a quick aside, I don't know if I've mentioned this yet, but at the last tail end of Simon Dupree, our keyboard player was a gentleman called Reginald Dwight. And Reg Dwight was a fantastic player, and he became good friends with myself and Ray. And we whispered in his ear because he wrote a couple of songs for Simon Dupree, which we recorded. Because he was a great writer, and he'd met this guy called Bernie Taupin, and they were writing songs together. And we mentioned to him that we were thinking of breaking up the band and starting something new, something very interesting. And we don't know what it's going to be, but we want it to be new, interesting, and God knows what else. And he said, I'd love to audition or be part of that. And we said, sure, we'd love to hear what you've got. And we went, myself and Ray went up to his house in Watford with his mom there, and Bernie was there. And he played songs like Skyline Pigeon and Your Song, et cetera. And, he was a friend, so we didn't say no. But when we got home, we kind of spoke to Reg and said, Reg, this is not going to work. Because it was really too poppy for us. And thank goodness for him we said that, because 2 years later, he was gigantic. We were scrambling for gigs. So, that's a kind of a story which I think is well known. But at the same time, you're asking about the formation of Gentle Giant. We interviewed, many, many players. Kerry Muneer was the first new player we brought on board, the keyboard player. And we were very fortunate and incredibly fortunate to find him because he just graduated from the Royal Academy of Music with a degree in composition and completely classically trained. We went through, I don't know how many guitarists, maybe 150 guitarists who came in to be the guitarist of the band. And Gary just came in and was probably one of the strangest thing was one of the first guys to ask if he could tune up. So that was a plus on that side. But he was obviously extraordinarily gifted and talented, albeit in a very much bluesier way than we expected. But nevertheless, he was a great guitarist and a good guy. And we had a drummer called Martin Smith from in the area, who lasted a couple of albums. He was a little jazzy, but that was a formation of the band.
When I hear Gentle Giant, I get this sense of almost competitiveness. I mean, playing very complex passages, almost an exercise of dexterity, but locked in with all the other band members, of course. Was there an urge to be complex, almost to create a new form of music at that point?
We didn't have any... Well, I mean, as far as urge is concerned, the page from Simon Dupree was turned, and it was a blank page. So we didn't know what and how and where Gentle Giant was going. What we did know is that we had good players in the band, and we wanted to do something which is different and not be Simon Dupree to the Big Sound and not be Amen Corner and or whatever bands that there were around. And at the same time, bands in that time were evolving also. The League of Gentlemen became King Crimson. Band of Joy became Led Zeppelin. So we were all looking to do something different. And what we did differently was almost like a 180 from where our band was prior to the Simon Dupree, prior to that time. So we, I think, probably wanted to get away as far away from that ugly period where we had to play pop songs as we could. But not to the point of being a complex for the sake of it, if you like. It was just what we wanted to do, and it was a lot of fun. And we pushed ourselves personally, musically, for each other first. And if we were able to garner fans, ultimately, when we went on stage, that was a bonus for us.
And where you once had the community with Simon Dupree of, like you said, the Beatles and Pink Floyd and the bands around there, what you're talking about now at Gentle Giant, that's kind of the birth of what we now call prog rock. Was there a community around yourselves, Yes, Emerson, Lake and Palmer and the like?
Not so much, actually. It was it was in the early 70s. There were in the mid to late 60s, all the bands were, there was a big community. There was a lot of, communal trust, and support for every band out there, because there was a small, amount of bands doing all these tours all over Europe, actually, and we were all supporting each other and knew each other. And in the 70s, it became a little more competitive because the bands that wanted to be bigger became bigger. I mean, Led Zeppelin, as I said before, were a different band in Birmingham. Episode Six, who were a fun band in London, became Deep Purple, et cetera, et cetera. So there was less of a community. But and again, we didn't know what prog was. All we knew is what we were doing was good for us, and hopefully people would enjoy it because it was a little different. Mm-hmm. So not really. So I wouldn't say there was a big support group, if you like. And in fact, when we went on tour, we would tour with artists who were nothing like us. There were, our first U.S. tour, in fact, was with Black Sabbath. Mm. So that says a lot, if you understand what that means.
Yeah. And they were label mates of yours at Vertigo. Did the touring work with Black Sabbath, or was it a complete mismatch?
Oh, it was one of the most hilarious mismatches in the history of the business. However, but we were great friends of theirs because we also shared the same management. So in that respect, we knew the guys really well, and at the time, Sabbath had their first gigantic hit, and they became very popular very quickly, and we were still sort of trying to make it work. Even though we were doing quite well in Europe, we came to the States with Sabbath, and we were initially, when we went on stage, there was people were heckling us and booing us, et cetera. We were able to break through that heckle, the heckle mongers, fairly well because we were adept at bringing a crowd in, no matter what audience we were playing to, because of our history with Simon Dupree, and if you like. In that respect, we were lucky that we played a great deal, we did 10 nights a week with Simon Dupree, so we were able to get that crowd on our side for the most part. But yes, it was an awful mismatch, but for the most part, we were able to make our mark and ultimately go back and get our own crowd.
And with Vertigo, again, you signed to Vertigo, you released the self-titled album. Was the reception as expected? Was it less? Was it more? How did you feel about it once it came out?
Well, I felt it was good. Uh-huh. I thought it was really, listen, when you do something brand new and it's something which is, something that is your baby and it's born, it's your firstborn, you think is the best thing you've ever done and you've ever heard. And you've ever will do, we thought it was great, but it was it went out to kind of mixed reaction, I would say. The management liked it, not loved it. Some fans liked it, some didn't. But we were able to tour with this album and continue as a band. It sold enough for the Vertigo to say, let's do another album if you like. So we were able to tour on it and garner fans who would enjoy the band live. So in the respect of how it was received by us, we loved it. But how it was received by people who would be ultimately fans, some people loved it, some people didn't like it. So what can I say? It wasn't a big hit.
The movement between the self-titled and then acquiring the Taste, it seems the band really dug into their stance in terms of doing something new, exploring new boundaries. That was a conscientious decision, but based on the liner notes and the, I guess, manifesto inside the second album. Again, the response to the second album, as expected, less than expected, what was your opinion?
As expected. To be perfectly honest, because we knew that actually it was done, that album was done in the studio for the most part, and it was an experimental album. We wrote stuff before, but I would say at least a third to a half of the music was done, was written in the studio with a click crack and just being creative, if that makes any sense, in the studio, even though it probably in those days was not a smart move. But we didn't take a lot of time in the studio. We were actually fairly adept and fairly decently speedy in putting things down. But that album was done without a lot of music written, whereas the first album was one, as I said to you before, a half or 9 months of writing for this new album, and it became our stage show. Whereas going into for the second album, it was, okay, now we could do a second album. What should we do? Well, let's start writing, and what we hadn't finished, we would do in the studio. So it became fairly experimental, but what it did do is start paving the way to something which ultimately Gentle Giant became. It was less of a bridge between Simon Dupree and Gentle Giant, which the first album probably was, and more towards what ultimately it would be.
Creating the identity that would then carry.
Correct.
On. Okay.
Yeah.
Now, a couple records later, you went from Vertigo to WWA, and that was the label, of course, the same trajectory with Black Sabbath. I guess you said you had the same manager. Was that Patrick Meehan?
Correct. Yes, it was.
And what was WWA? That was an affiliation of bands owning their music? How was that structured?
Basically bandits who are mafia based and basically cajoled Phonogram out of getting their music, for the most part. I shouldn't say that, but it's the truth. Mm-hmm. Really we were, we signed a deal, which was, it wasn't bad actually. It was a good deal compared with Sabbath and other bands of those ilk. But to tell you the truth, they helped a lot in getting us pretty far forward. However, the management and the company were less than honorable, if you like, in the way they worked with the artists and money. Sabbath, in fact, really got screwed royally. I mean, if you like, we were lucky enough, I think, in that I and my brothers realized that what we had signed was the wrong thing to do. So we went in there and basically said we want off. But nevertheless, we had a deal with Worldwide Arts, which went through Phonogram, which was Vertigo. And in the rest of the world, we had signed a deal with Columbia Records and ultimately with Capitol Records. So at least we had some trajectory in North America, which was very important to us.
Which countries had the biggest love for Gentle Giant in the day?
Well, when we first started, we were just touring everywhere. And, again, this is something that we learned as Simon Dupree, is you have to present yourself in a way that is entertainment as well as great music. We knew how to do that. I think that's something that was very important to us. I would say that Italy was one of our major markets, first big major markets. Germany, ultimately, we were very lucky in the respect we became headliners pretty much all over Western Europe and North America. But the first countries, if you like, that took to us, I would say Italy and Germany, and then French Canada, and then the major urban areas in North America, and then other major territories in Europe. UK, not so much, believe it or not. We'd headline 2,000 seaters, but for the most part, we were not put into the league of ELP or Genesis or Yes. We were kind of like not, to be sniffed at as opposed to cheered, if you like.
Now, Gentle Giant seems to have been around at the beginning of what we now call prog rock. Of course, then it didn't have a name. It was just an evolution of popular music. Were you able at the time to really see the difference in what people were looking for at that moment in music?
Yeah, the fans of, if you like, prog, and honestly, I didn't even know we were prog until we were told, this is back in the day, that we were in a movement, in a bag, if you like. But to tell you, for as far, so yes, there is a kind of a elitism,
yes,
to a degree. However, you know, as far as I'm concerned, prog means progressive, which means going forward, which means that whatever you do and wherever you go, it's okay. The fans sometimes are a little landlocked into something that they believe should be this way, not that way. And in that respect, you know, I think that some of the bands I've been involved in, whether on the other side of the fence, if you like, and as you know, I've been on the dark side of the business for a few years as well. You know, bands like Dream Theater, who are prog, but certainly metal, but one of the most progressive bands I ever signed, if you like, was Pantera. Because they were unbelievably talented, musically adept, and did something which was very different at that time. And that's progressive in its own way. So using that term is a little kind of a wishy-washy as far as I'm concerned, but I understand you have to have some kind of bag where you're dropped into. So I understand that. If you don't play songs in a 4-4 manner and you don't play songs with 3 or 4 chords, it's a little different. So I understand what it is, but I think there's elements of elitism involved.
And as you just mentioned, you went to the dark side of the business. You went from musician, from artist, to then working for PolyGram, I believe, director of promotion, artist development. How was that shift, that transition for you?
A gigantic wake-up call. To tell you the truth, it was a very interesting time because I was asked by a friend who I knew from Chrysalis Records days when we decided to break the band up. A year after, I was offered to do productions, do more band stuff, and I said, you know, I want to try something new. This is the same thing as breaking the Simon Dupree to Gentle Giant. Try something new. If you don't try something, you'll never know. And if you get stuck into a bag, and it feels like you're just clocking in like a job, it's time to stop. And that's what happened at the end of Gentle Giant. I'll just put it that way. But I was offered the situation to work at PolyGram, and I said, let me try. So I was living in California at the time with my wife and my daughter. I went to New York, and I went into my first office and went around in the very first day to the various offices of the people I was working with, and realized at the end of the day, I went in at 10 o'clock, and by 6 o'clock, I realized that this wasn't the music business at all. It was a business of music. A lot of these people were very they enjoyed the music, but their perks and the sales and the being backstage and star fucking, if you like, was as important as breaking the artist. And that kind of like was a big knot in my stomach and a gulp in my throat. And I said, I can't wait to get the hell out of here. Meanwhile, so here I am 38 years later, still in the side of the fence. So what can I tell you? But what I thought, and I'll be honest with you, I thought, well, okay, number one, I need the job because I needed to pay the rent. And number two, if I can make a difference, knowing and having had my experiences on the side of being an artist and being artist friendly, if you know what I mean, and understanding how it feels to go on stage and how to write and how to make a record. And at the same time, understanding what it takes on the other side of the fence to work every piece of the room, if you like, and the room are full of people who have their own agendas, then I can possibly help the artists that I'm involved in to do their very best.
And it sounds like it was a very confronting when you first started and perhaps discouraging. Do you remember the activity or the event or the moment when you all of a sudden started looking at it very differently, perhaps with optimism?
Yeah, because, yes, I did. Because there were, as I said to you, there were people there that were in it for a different reason. But there were other people there that were there for the love of music. So I bonded with them. And we collectively said, let's make this company happen. At the time the company was combining their forces from a Dutch and German company into one company in North America. And for the most part, they were kind of mid-level troops who were running the company, and they became close friends. and we believed in the artists. And in that respect, we were able to help make the company a successful company.
Now, the way I understand, the first band you signed was Bon Jovi. Is that right?
Yeah, I think, you know, people know that my very first signing was Bon Jovi. And they've just been inducted to the Hall of Fame, which, you know, good for them because they deserve it. Even though the elitists will say, well, Derek Shulman signed Bon Jovi, that's terrible. Well, no, come on. I mean, it's just music. You know, but of course, you know, it's the 180 from where I was as Gentle Giant. However, you know, understanding what the business was about and where Bon Jovi sat in the big picture, I saw him and I helped put the band together with him. He was very driven. He wanted it badly. He was also very smart commercially. And I guess I knew in my gut that it was going to happen. So yes, it was my very first signing within the first 3 months that I joined Polygram.
When you sign an artist, obviously they have to have talent, they have to have good music. What are the other check boxes you have to tick in order to feel confident going forward?
They have to believe that they, how can I put this? If they're not driven, if they're not doing it 100%, without any 1% difference that is done by somebody else. If they're not driven to make it happen on their own, it will never work. They have to believe in themselves 100%. And even if you know, Polygram or Columbia or Warner's drop them, if they don't believe that they're going to do it, then they will never make it. They have to have their own self-belief and the belief of their music. And even if no one loves them, if they don't do that, if they only believe that they will only get big because other people have invested in them, it will never happen. That's one reason, one thing. And there's several other things. You have to have to be the biggest, you have to have some unique quality. You can't be just a follower. A follower can make a living, but to be the biggest, you have to have something unique.
So, Derek, you've been around music and the music industry for years. You've seen and ridden trends and witnessed changes in cultural taste. What do you think the future is for music and the music industry in general?
Oh, boy. Well, let me just say this. You know, when I started enjoying music, I used to buy 45 RPM singles. And that was a way of listening to music. Nowadays, it's listening to Spotify and people. So you know, and there was a heyday, there was a golden era in the music business, if you like, where for the artists and the record companies, you would buy albums and then CDs, etc. And now it's streaming and the artists will scream blue murder because they're not getting paid enough. But one thing is going to be constant. There's always going to be music. There's always going to be artists that will become popular. In whatever genre there is. So however, let me just say this, that in the 60s and perhaps in the early 70s, music drove the culture. In the 70s and 80s, and especially ultimately the 90s, the internet drove the culture. We lost music as a cultural standalone in what was important as far as the world's concerned. And in that respect, I think the world has lost a great deal as we see now what's happening with social media and the internet and everything else affecting other people's lives. Whereas music back in the day, and I'll say this, was much more true and has some altruism to it. So in the respect that culturally we've lost that is a shame. But nevertheless, music's going to continue, you know, whether it's hip hop, whether it's electronica, whether it's you know, AI or whatever it is, people are going to have music in their lives. It may be not as important as it used to be, but it's always going to be there because it's almost like a primal thing that you need to have. So you asked me a question, which if I could answer, what's on the radar? I wish I knew, but nevertheless. Whatever it is, kids are going to enjoy it. Kids and adults and everyone else are going to enjoy it because music is never going to go away. It's a primal force that is inherited and in as part of our DNA. So, you know, I'm not going to be around when this is going to be artificially put together by robots, which is probable, but nevertheless, it's going to be important to whoever it is that listens to it.
Now, in terms of artists today, and you're still signing artists, you're still representing artists, are there more artists out there compared to, say, 20, 30 years ago? Is it a more target-rich environment now, or are you finding that perhaps in the past there seemed to be a lot more to choose from?
No, there are thousands and thousands of artists out there. There always has been. You know, anyone, you know, there's always been thousands and thousands of artists out there, especially from the sort of 70s, if you like. In the 60s, it was just learning. You know, as I said, the Beatles changed everything. And the English sort of, the English Brit culture coming over to North America changed everything. And since then, since that time, kids have bought a guitar and strummed an E, A, and B, and you know, and said, I could be a star too. In this day and age, people pick up their computers and plug in their MIDIs and or whatever the garage band and say, I can be a star too. That's something which is interesting because that is something which is not quite as, how can I put this, not quite as fulfilling as far as I'm concerned, but nevertheless, it's a truism, it's a reality. Yes, there's as many, if not more, artists making music today than there was back in the day. The problem is that in today's age with social media and YouTube, these artists and musicians and everyone else want to make it today. They make music yesterday and they put the music on whether it's Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and they get lots of views and this, that, and the other, and believe and think that they should be big. Well, it happens occasionally, but you know what? What we did back in the day was play to fans and had real fans, and ultimately, our work, if you like, and our heritage and our legacy, believe it or not, is still around. And here we are talking about Gentle Giant, and Gentle Giant's last appearance was in 1980. It's now 2017. That was 37 years ago. So, in the respect that we're talking about what was. And that was something that we did because we wanted to play. And I think that some of these artists, or a lot of these artists, or a lot of musicians who are putting their music up on YouTube and Instagram and wherever, whatever other things are available to them, and believing they should be big because they're getting millions of views and they're fun and funny and whatever they are, you need to have some legs and ability to play and have a fan base that will stick with you through the decades and through the years to really have it make a difference. And that's something that I'm afraid is not happening quite as much.
I always seem to think, and just even looking at my kids, they have so many other things to divide their time. When
Correct.
Back, you know, years and years ago, you would get a guitar and you would just work with that guitar for 4 hours a day. It seems to me that in some way, culturally, we have to suffer through that, the huge menu of choice that we have to do.
Correct.
At a given moment.
That's the reality of today, and if you don't want to face the reality, then you start becoming blinkered and landlocked into a time frame. So you know it is what it is, and mm-hmm. and you have to understand that's what it is, and you enjoy it. I mean, believe it or not, Gentle Giant has had 3 number one records in the last year in North America, albeit sampled songs from artists who in the hip-hop world where we're apparently admired in a big, very big way. The big movie coming out in January, Black Panther, has been sampled by a band called Run the Jewels, a song called Knots from Octopus, and that's the initial trailer of the movie. So you know, Common has sampled Gentle Giant. Tribe Called Quest sampled Gentle Giant, and they've all had number one albums. So in that respect, our music is still alive in different forms.
And how do you want Gentle Giant to be remembered years from now?
Good question. I think that we would like to be remembered as a band that didn't and wouldn't and couldn't succumb to commerciality, wanted to remain true to what we were as musicians, and try to push ourselves as musicians personally to be better for each other, and then ultimately to be better for fans and lovers of music that we play to on stage and for recordings.
And it sounds like, through the relationship with Stephen Wilson and the like, Gentle Giant is not just going through a bit of a renaissance, but also the legacy is getting remastered and treated in a way that will hopefully last beyond what was originally expected, yeah?
Right. Well, again, I'm very happy about that. And in fact, the nice thing about what's happening here is that kids and younger people are listening and hearing something that they never heard or hadn't heard before, and picking up their guitars and keyboards and various things and trying something new, as opposed to doing something which is, you know, something that they haven't done before. So it's nice to hear that young fans are listening to our old farts who are kind of on our last legs, if you like.
All right. Well, hopefully the music lasts far beyond that generation as well. Derek, I do want to thank you for spending time with us here on The Vinyl Guide and sharing your history and, of course, those stories from back in the day. We love hearing those. And I want to make sure the audience knows all about Three Piece Suite. This is a remaster of some of the selected tracks from Gentle Giant's first three LPs. Of course, Gentle Giant, Acquiring the Taste, Three Friends. Some people call it their golden period, but with a band as rich in history as Gentle Giant, with such a large catalog, there could be many golden periods. It's all remastered by Stephen Wilson. It's available on 180-gram vinyl. And of course, if you want to learn more about that, where to get it, or any other Gentle Giant news, you can always go to facebook.com/Gentle Giant Band. Derek, thanks again for joining us here on The Vinyl Guide.
It's my pleasure. Great speaking to you.
The track Three Friends, originally from the Gentle Giant album titled Three Friends. However, what you just heard was the remix of the song Taken from the LP Three Piece Suite by Gentle Giant. Again, it's available on vinyl and 5:1 surround Blu-ray wherever you buy your music. grab a copy. These sound incredible. Alrighty, well, that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for downloading, and thanks in advance for sharing this episode with your record collecting friends. Of course, you could always lead them to thevinylguide.com. There's a whole list of episodes, well over 100, with heaps of guests. There's something for everyone there at thevinylguide.com. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode. So until then, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.